Mark Brewer as former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. Jeff Timmer as former executive director of the Michigan Republicans. And this is a Republic, if you can keep it, with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer.
Thanks for joining us on A Republic, If You Can Keep It. Later in the podcast, we'll be joined by our special guest, Congressman Andy Levin, Democrat from Oakland County. But first, Mark, let's chew over some of the latest political developments in Michigan and across the country.
Yeah, why don't we start with the late Friday before the holiday weekend news dump by the Republican Party that without conceding they broke the law, they paid a $200,000 fine over Ron Weiser when he was chair previously, taking that amount of money and essentially buying Stan Grott, a candidate for Secretary of State, out of the election, essentially bought him out. The story goes so that there could be a female candidate on the Republican ticket back in 2018, and that was the rationale. And as part of the big fight last winter with outgoing chair Laura Cox, she not only commissioned an investigation of all of that, but then turned over the results of the investigation to the Secretary of State. Something remarkable. I've never seen anything like that in Michigan history, that inter-party fight got so bitter that Laura Cox did that as she was walking out the door. And now the Republican Party has paid the price. Again, even though they don't admit there's anything wrong, it was pretty clear from reading that memo that the law was broken. And the size of the fine also indicates that there was some lawbreaking going on. But the Republicans have paid a huge amount of money to make that all go away. But I don't think we've seen all the shoes drop there yet. There still could be some fallout from that. What do you think, Jeff?
Well, at the time back when Stan Grott, when he got out of the race, right before the eve, on the eve of the convention back in 2018, when he was about to win, become the nominee, it was clear that something strange was up. There was a whole lot of speculation that I heard at the time, knowing the players involved, that, you know, there was something transactional in nature. And then, you know, last winter, when this whole news of the $200,000 payment became public, it wasn't a surprise to a lot of people who had followed that and paid attention. It was, okay, that makes sense. So when you look back at the folly of that, you know, a $200,000 payment orchestrated to make sure a woman lost to Jocelyn Benson instead of a man, now turned compounded into a $400,000 payment to lose a race. It's just, you know, essentially, you know, Weiser made the comment in the documents and accounts that came out last winter about the first $200,000 when Cox had questioned him on this, effectively saying, I was the party's biggest donor. It was my money anyway. So he's essentially now, as of the news last Friday, this conciliatory agreement to put in another $200K. He's essentially had to like offer up a dollar for dollar matching fund out of his own pocket to cover the money from his own pocket, you know, 3 years ago. It is extraordinary. And it really does pull back the veil a little bit on the party administrative fund, something maybe unique to Michigan. I don't know if other states do it, but I know, you know, you and I have both been involved in the administration of party funds and party monies. And so we know what those funds can and should be used for. This is not something that they're typically used for, is, you know, massive payoffs to candidates. That's anybody who's been around politics for a long time might come across things that may not pass the smell test, that they're a little bit hinky, but I've never seen anything like this before in my time.
Right. You know, and I think there should be more repercussions here. I got to be candid with you, because $200,000 is chump change to Ron Weiser to make this go away. I think there could be a criminal prosecution here for violation of the Campaign Finance Act and also the election code, because that basically was interference in the Republican Party nominating process. And also, there's been no complaint filed against Grott. I mean, Grott took that money. And then according to the Warner Norcross report that Laura Cox turned over to the Secretary of State, he went out and did candidate-related work. which you cannot do with administrative account money. So I think there should be, and I hope there will be, further ramifications here to make sure this kind of thing doesn't happen again. And of course, now what we're also seeing is Wiser very publicly bragging about he's going to use this fund to finance the voter suppression drive that he's planning on. Again, hide the donors. We don't know. We suspect, have ideas who may have made contributions to that fund over the years. But he's going to be able to tell them, give me millions of dollars so I can do this voter suppression petition drive, and nobody will ever know that you are behind it. And so this administrative account is really becoming a real significant problem. And I hope, again, there'll be further investigation and further punishment here for the misuse of it.
Well, I agree that we need further investigation here, because if either party is just able to thumb their nose at the law and the campaign finance requirements, if they're just able to say, look, we're going to take a gamble here. We're going to, you know, funnel this money through the administrative fund, even though it should be reported under the ballot initiative through a ballot question committee. And, you know, if we get called on the carpet like we did with the Stan Grott payment, we'll just sign a conciliatory agreement, pay a fine. If, as long as somebody's willing to underwrite that, that undermines the entire intent of the system. That's just a dangerous route to go. If we can just have somebody willing to say, let's gamble, let's knowingly disobey the law, and then we'll just write a check if we get caught.
Right. It normalizes it. And you simply assume that it's the cost of doing business, right? That as we're analyzing our risks here, well, you know, if we're willing to pay that kind of fine, we can break the law. We cannot go down that path. I mean, we're not there yet, but I look at what goes on at the federal level with the Federal Election Commission, which because of its structure deadlocks all the time. And we've effectively had no enforcement of the federal campaign finance laws for years, if not over a decade now. We're not in that position in Michigan, but if people think they can buy their way out of legal violations like this and just go on their way, we're down that path. And that's a very dangerous path to go down.
Well, one other thing that's been interesting that stems from this whole payment back in August of 2018 to Stan Grott is the fact that when Laura Cox succeeded Ron Wiser as chair and then discovered this, it has led to a very bitter public exchange of rhetoric between Wiser and Cox and their allies. And interestingly, now there is a story out this week from Tim Skubick that Laura's husband, former attorney general and one-time gubernatorial candidate Mike Cox, is considering a run for governor, which, you know, I've worked closely with Mike in the past. I was involved in his campaign in 2010 when he lost the Republican nomination. He's not a rash candidate. He's very calculating and strategic. I can see him taking a look at this. I can see him doing it, one, because he would be a legitimate contender, but two, because he can, by dipping his toes in the water, announcing or not poo-pooing the notion altogether, or saying he's looking at an exploratory committee or whatever, he can throw a wrench in Wiser's plan to coronate former Detroit police chief Jim Craig.
Yeah, no, I agree that Cox could be a formidable candidate in a Republican primary, given his history. Laura Cox, obviously there, her extensive history, background, party chair, among other things. Yeah, so that could be a very, very interesting development. Cox has developed a good legal practice, from what I can tell. He's got a lot of these cases against the University of Michigan over Robert Anderson. But there may be a way that he can kind of do both, right? That he can still, you know, dip his toes in the water about running for governor and do his work there while still maintaining his law practice.
Not that there's a lot of similarities between Jeff Figer and Mike Cox, but Figer found a way to do that. And where there's a will, there's a way.
That's right. And apropos of dark money, And we all know that you can use the corporate money from your business to run issue ads. And both sides of the aisle have done that. And that's actually been legal under Michigan law for a long time, unlike the Grot situation that we discussed.
Mark and Jeff will be joined by Congressman Andy Levin after these messages.
Epic MRA is pleased to be a sponsor of this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, federal, state, and local issues. Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, and local governments across the state. When it comes to measuring voter opinions, Epic MRA has been known as the go-to Michigan pollster for over 25 years. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
The Michigan Polycast. It's been called one of Michigan's top political podcasts by Hourly Detroit.
Each week, longtime political junkies Christine Barry and Walt Sorg offer news and views on Michigan politics and policy, as well as national issues impacting our pleasant peninsulas. And they are joined by some of the state's biggest names from government, politics, academia, and nonprofit groups, with an in-depth look at those issues.
Subscribe now to the Michigan Polycast, online at www.michiganpolycast.com.
Our guest today is Oakland County Member of Congress, Andy Levin, who represents not only part of Oakland County, but part of my home county of Macomb. Congressman Levin carries on a half-century family tradition of public service. He was elected in 218 to succeed his father, Sandy Levin, who served in Congress for 26 years, and before that, in the state Senate, and also as a candidate for governor twice. His uncle, Carl Levin, of course, served in the United States Senate for 36 years. His great-uncle, Charles Levin, served in the Michigan Court of Appeals and the Michigan Supreme Court for a combined 30 years, and I had the privilege of being one of his law clerks during that time. So an extraordinary family and extraordinary member of Congress, Andy Levin.
In Congress, Representative Levin is vice chair of the Education and Labor Committee and is a member of the Committee on Foreign Affairs. Prior to his election to Congress, he was acting director of the state's Department of Energy, Labor, and Economic Growth. It's a pleasure to welcome Andy Levin to the podcast.
Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Thanks for being here. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So, Andy, here we go. 6 months in to the Congress, almost 6 months into the Biden presidency. Give us your assessment. You know, how's the Congress doing so far? How's Biden doing so far? What's on the to-do list? Big question to get going here.
Well, we're recording this on the actual 6 month anniversary of the insurrection at the Capitol. So that's on my mind. And it's very strange thing that our democracy is hanging by a thread. And one of our two major parties is continuing to worship an emperor with no clothes. And we need two parties that have very different ideas or more, right, to have a democracy, that want to debate issues and be, you know, really have it out on the issues of the day. And instead of that, I'm afraid the Republican Party continues to be captured by this kind of charlatan. And it's extremely troubling, because 6 months ago when we were there in the Capitol, we really almost lost our democracy. But that is going on at the same time as we are trying to zoom ahead with the business of the people. And so to answer your question, Mark, first of all, I give Joe Biden incredibly high marks for coming out of the gate with a presidency. I mean, the 3 million jobs in the first 5 months of a presidency has never been seen before, a net growth of 3 million jobs. His intense focus on getting America vaccinated has been really terrific. We still have a lot of hesitancy, and let's admit it, we're a lot slower than some other countries because we don't have a national health system. I mean, there was a lot here in Michigan. We focus on the Canadian border and going back and forth. We used to run to Windsor to eat Chinese. All of y'all remember that. But anyway, you know, on June 21st, the Canada and the United States delayed again opening up our borders. And there was a lot of press about how, Canada's only 20% fully vaccinated. Well, guess what? Canada had been 70% first dose vaccinated. And by July 21st, Canada will have zoomed ahead of the United States and be 75, maybe even 80% fully vaccinated, because A, they have a national health system, and B, they don't have the kind of nutcase, right, political related hesitancy that we see in the United States. But so the Biden administration gets good marks on dealing with the pandemic. And then more broadly, this American Rescue Plan, you know, setting the stage for rocketing out of the pandemic recession was very good. But we still have so much business to do, Mark. And there's a, you know, the question is, how much of that can we actually get done with the Senate being 50-50? And, you know, the House, we have a very slim majority in the House, and there isn't a lot of bipartisanship around. So that's the question.
Well, you've just described, you know, it's, on one hand, there's the business of the government, of the Congress, that still needs to happen. Yet the you're dealing with trying to prop up and defend democracy. I wrote in a piece that appeared in the Michigan Advance this weekend, I said we didn't escape the collapse of our Democratic Republic on January 6th. We merely avoid it happening that day. And when you look across that aisle, you see, you know, the 210 or whatever Republicans there are, the vast majority of them, 70% of them, objected to the certification of the election. They were going to overthrow the election. They participate in the big lie. You look at that and think it's not merely political opponents. You know, Mark and I, you know, we've talked on this podcast about how we've been opponents, but not enemies. We're in a situation now where they're not just political opponents. They're enemies of democracy. They're enemies of the rule of law. They're enemies of free and fair elections. And that's just a whole new ballgame when it comes to how we conduct the business of our democracy, the aftermath of an election. It never dawned on me to just contest the whole thing as illegitimate during my years running the Republican Party. You know, when Jennifer Granholm won re-election in 2006, I didn't say it's fraud. The election was stolen. We licked our wounds and went on to the next election. And that's what it must be so hard for people in your position to have to deal with these members of the, you know, the Trump party in committee and in the course of your daily business, knowing what their intent is.
Yeah, I mean, you're so right, Jeff, and that's so well said. By the way, you didn't do too badly when you came back around the next election after Granholm won re-election, and that's how it goes, right? I mean, look, I'm 60, dude. I still play hockey. I hate losing in beer league at the age of 60. I'm like a kid. But at the end of every game, you know, we take off our gloves and go down the line and shake each other's hands, even if you got your butt kicked. And you come back and play the next time. And I just, you're right. It's they're talking about ending the game altogether and starting a different kind of game. And we have this 230-plus year experiment with democratic self-government, and they are talking about ending that and going into a different kind of thing. And it's especially weird around July 4th, right? Because what does patriotism mean? I mean, it means loving. It's not a flag itself. It's what it symbolizes, what we've gone through, how many people have died fighting to protect this ideal that a bunch of scraggly people who went off to this continent and kind of, you know, we may not have agreed about a lot of things, and we, you know, may have done some things wrong to the people who were already here. But anyway, we started this idea that we're going to govern ourselves. There's going to be no king, and it's all of that is threatened. It's, I mean, I'll tell you, Jeff, I'll give you an example. Actually, it's something that's been in the news of late, because I wrote the resolution that passed the House about the coup in Burma or Myanmar. You know, I'm on the Foreign Affairs Committee, and I'm the vice chair of the Asia subcommittee. So I wrote this and I said, well, I got to, you know, we do a lot of stuff bipartisan in the Foreign Affairs Committee in particular. I said, well, I got to have a Republican co-sponsor. And I was taking the position very early on that I didn't want to have like any co-sponsors who were insurrectionists, you know, who were, to me, they tried to overthrow democracy. And then we went down the list and, you know, the ranking member of the
Senate, isn't it?
it was like impossible. And so, you know, I think, I guess at the same time, we want to not downplay or diminish how much democracy is threatened on the one hand, and on the other hand, continue to move forward with governing and try to maintain relations with people who shouldn't be doing what they're doing, but are doing it presumably out of fear and lack of courage rather than true belief. There's so many of my colleagues, they know that the election wasn't stolen. I think they even know what kind of a person Donald Trump is. But he, as you said, it's the Trump party now. I mean, he took over the base and they're scared of the base, so they go with it. But it's a shameful situation. And it's a dark time for our democracy in that sense.
Well, Andy, nonetheless, you think you can get some stuff done. What about the infrastructure package?
You know, I've kind of understood the president's plan on this for some time, because I was talking to Steve Ricchetti on the phone months ago, and he said, look, we're going to do this bipartisan thing. And yet I know the president's the one who proposed the American Jobs Plan and the American Families Plan. And in addition to the American Rescue Plan. So this is kind of Rooseveltian stuff. It's a generational kind of investment that we haven't seen in our people and our infrastructure in a long time. So he said, well, nonetheless, the president obviously has decades of a reputation and a reality of being really a bipartisan guy. So he wants to get a bipartisan package done. And I said, okay, you know, I'm supporting the president. I'd rather have one big package, but, you know, if that's what he wants to do. So he did succeed in getting that. And then there was the flap when he said, well, you know, we have to have this, you know, we have to have a budget deal at the same time. And the Republicans said, oh, he's threatening to veto that. And, you know, perhaps he could have said it differently. I don't know. But I think that his plan and our plan has been consistent all along, and the Republicans know it very well, that we will do a bipartisan thing on what they agree with us on. And it's a big infrastructure. I laud the Republicans who agreed to this. It's great. This much investment into roads, bridges, sewers, and beyond. I mean, it has more rail, more transit than we've invested in generations. But at the same time, we've got to, you can't have a recovery without childcare. You can't have, you know, a real America leading the world without, you know, freeing up people to be able to go to college. And we can't save the planet without much more legislation tackling climate change. So we're gonna try to do this thing of passing a bipartisan package and passing an FY fiscal year 2022 budget at the same time or in conjunction with each other. And I don't think there's any other way to do it, because progressives won't vote for a bipartisan package when that's all there is, and then we are not going to have the rest of it. And, you know, moderates won't vote for the humongo package without, you know, the bipartisan aspect. So they've got to be married to each other, and it's going to be a very interesting balancing act with no room for error. Like, as you know, zero. I mean, the budget will require every single Democrat to vote for it, plus the vice president breaking the tie. So, and then the House, you know, don't diminish how close the House is either. I mean, you know, out of 435, we just have a margin of a few. And so, you know, the speaker has a very high and wavy tightrope to walk as she tries to get the package through the House. So it's going to be very interesting. But I'm hopeful we'll get it done.
Right. I mean, I think Pelosi's just done an amazing job. I was so glad she was there as our leader opposing Trump, standing up to him. But, you know, managing, you know, the House through all of this with such a tight margin, with such a, you know, a polarized caucus, right? I mean, we're all Democrats, but wide variety of folks. You know, kudos to her and to you and all the other folks. Because like you said, you know, with such a small margin, you can't afford to lose 2, 3, 4 votes. You don't make it. You don't make it at all.
A lot of people really don't like her. They demonize her or something. I don't know. I would challenge people to find a more masterful political leader than Nancy Pelosi of any era of either party. Mark, you get there. And she knows your name. She knows who you are. She knows what your interests are. I mean, there's 230 some Democrats, right? And as you say, the range is incredibly broad between the most conservative and the most progressive. And she listens to everybody, supports everybody, says, you know, we all need to be here. And it's like a sort of a happy cacophony. And somehow she manages to, you know, keep people together. And I find it remarkable. You know, I'll just tell you one little story that exemplifies it to me. When we got elected at first, there was a contest to be the chair of the caucus. And I didn't know, you know, what do I know? It's like, okay, whatever. I didn't realize what a big deal it was. And it came down to a vote of the caucus between Hakeem Jeffries and Barbara Lee. And Hakeem won the vote, and he made it the outgoing caucus chair, who was the guy that AOC defeated, right, in a primary. He gave a speech. What's his name? Joe, you guys.
Gosh, the guy from New York. Yeah, I can't think of his name.
Yeah. Anyway, he's the Irish guy who used to sing. So people are like, sing, sing. So he gave a speech, and Hakeem gave a speech. Joe Crowley.
Yeah.
And then they moved on. And then here's Nancy Pelosi skittering around and whispering to someone. And, oh, they didn't have Barbara make a speech. And Pelosi, you know, she's there not only counting every vote, twisting every arm, stoking every ego, but taking care of people's feelings. You know, it was Barbara Lee did need to make a speech, and she was, you know, she did deserve that honor. So I, you know, Nancy Pelosi is just a masterful political leader, and she's gotten an incredible amount done, and I hope we'll continue to do so for the rest of this Congress under her leadership.
Are we going to be able to do anything, Andy, on voting rights? Whether it's the John Lewis Act or some parts of H.R. 1, anything possible there, short of changing the filibuster right in the Senate?
Well, we simply have to. And I don't know how it'll play out. But I mean, let's remember that the John Lewis Act or H.R. 4 won't save Michigan or won't save Iowa. Right. I mean, that is about restoring the part of the Voting Rights Act that the Supreme Court demolished earlier and restoring oversight over states that have a history of preventing African-Americans from voting fully. And Michigan or Iowa or states like that aren't on that list. So we need to pass that, but we really must pass substantial parts of H.R. 1 or the For the People Act, S-1, over in the Senate. And of course, we already passed it in the House. And the question is, as you kind of mentioned with the filibuster, what will happen in the Senate? I think that basically the people in the Senate who are saying they're not ready to vote for it yet, like Joe Manchin, who was a co-sponsor of it in the last Congress of S1, you know, and it's the same as it was then. They're going to have to make a decision. You've got somebody like Jeff Timmer here who, you know, a long time leading, you know, leader in the Republican Party, and so many others who are, you know, truly hold up. What I'm, Jeff, I don't know what parts you are, but, you know, small government, low taxes, free trade, whatever, you know, and it was all abandoned in the Trump era. And, you know, if we want to have two parties who, you know, we're going to have to protect everybody's right to vote and not say the way to win, instead of appealing to the most people is to sculpt the electorate to favor yourself and cut out the parts that don't favor you. No party can survive as a real legitimate party and to doing that. And I don't think they would want to, right? I mean, after all, you want to win. I mean, the Canadians want to come back and the Canadians want to come back and actually win. You know how when you're playing a sport and you're getting creamed and it's the time to end and you say last goal wins, you're down like 8-1, but you figure maybe you'll score the last goal. I mean, that's just cheating, you know? And so I think we're going to have to do something, Mark, but I don't know how it'll play out. Maybe they will, the filibuster already has several carve outs. So maybe they'll carve something out, or maybe they'll find some other way. But I do have to say personally, I wish they would go to the talking filibuster regardless. And I don't know what do you all think about that?
They made it far too easy, you know, just to file the intent to filibuster. It's a lot different when you have to stand there like Jimmy Stewart and, you know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, or when you've got to stand there like Strom Thurmond and talk for, you know, 7 days or whatever ridiculous thing he did, you know, reading the phone book. If you put the onus on the minority the person filing the filibuster to actually carry through and put their labor into it, it would make a big difference. But I wanted to go back to something you had said, even if you do pass these protections at the federal level, they may or may not impact what's going on in states like Michigan. And, you know, in the last week we've had, I think, a surprising development, a welcome development, with the report that came out from Ed McBroom in the Michigan Senate. And then today reports that, you know, Shirky, the Senate Majority Leader, the Republican, said that the assault on the election outcome by Trump and others is a serious threat to democracy. They're saying the right things, yet at the same time, those two individuals, they're getting a lot of praise for doing the right thing, but they're also big part of pushing these voting changes, 39 bills through the Senate, that will restrict voter freedoms, that will sculpt, using your term, who votes in the election. And so, you know, I know your focus is Washington, but we all need to be worried about what's going on in Lansing with these voting law changes, especially considering the Trump skew to the Supreme Court and to the federal appellate courts. So I be curious on your views of, the what could be done and what can change, what we need to, how vigilant we need to be with the voting law changes here in Michigan.
Well, I think they're a huge threat. I mean, I think we need to be really vigilant, and especially because, as you know, they can pass these things through the legislature, but then they can be vetoed. Then they can create a referendum with this language. I don't know if you can cram 39 bills into one referendum, but anyway, they can get the whatever parts, the worst parts they want. And then once it gets enough signatures and the language is validated, and how many states do this? Just one other or none? The legislature could just take up the language, pass it. And, you know, what does it take? 350,000 signatures to get
up? Not even. And yeah, it's so I've taken advantage of this before. I've been part of efforts where we've changed law and bypassed. At the time, it was bypassing, Governor Engler, Governor Snyder on prevailing wage. Mm-hmm. It was Republicans bypassing the Republicans. But still, it follows the black letter of the Constitution and the law. But 340,000 people out of 10 million residents and 7 million registered voters, it certainly defies the spirit of the Democratic intent of the citizens' right to initiative. That's too small a number, and that's a change we ought to, be willing to look at. Democrat, sane members of either side of the political aisle, and there's fewer of those on my former side these days, I'll grant you that.
Well, you're right. I mean, it's so, 340,000 people is something like 5% of the electorate. And not only is that way too few number of people to, you know, be for something, but as you know, they're not even necessarily for it. They, somebody approaches you in a strip mall parking lot and says, "Hey, Tim, or sign this." And you're like, "Get out of my face. I'll sign it." I mean, you may not even know what it's about. You don't have to, right? You're just a registered voter in that county and you sign it. That's all there is to it. So, you know, you could sign it for whatever reason. So it's just, it's really undemocratic and it's a big problem. But I do think that if we passed the For the People Act, HR1 and S1, it would supersede what the state legislature is trying to do. Just passing HR4 wouldn't do it because, you know, that federal law doesn't affect a state like Michigan. And anyway, we need to take specific action to prevent these kind of voter suppression tactics. And it's not just voter suppression, right? It's also you get to overturn the outcome if you don't like it. That's another part of what they're passing, right, which is incredible because, you know, again, it's just completely anti-democratic. It's what they tried to do with the insurrection on January 6th. And, you know, to set up doing that in a more quote unquote civilized way is, you know, no less undermining of democracy than doing it through a mob.
Sandy, as you know, you probably saw the reports over the weekend that the Republican Party was fined $200,000 for using dark money to basically buy a candidate out of a race back in 2018. And the Republican chair, Ron Wiser, has said, "We're going to use that same dark money account. No disclosure where the money comes from. It may come from him, for all we know, to finance this petition drive that you're talking about." So we are compounding the evils, right? We're going to suppress the vote through this mechanism, and we're going to fund it with millions of dollars of dark money, and nobody's ever going to know who's behind it. So these problems are now compounding each other in a system that we've built, allowed to be built over the years. And I know the federal legislation will do a lot about campaign finance disclosure at the federal level, but this is a Michigan problem as well in terms of this vast quantities of dark money. You've seen it in races that you've been involved in your leadership role, trying to get Democrats elected up and down the ticket in your district. You know, the vast quantities of dark money that come in and corrupt the election.
Well, and even the one time I ran for state office in Michigan in 2006, that's the only time I ran for office besides when I ran for Congress in 2018. But I was all proud that I outraised my opponent. But when all was said and done, the spending was they spent way more than we did. And Jeff, you may have been involved in this, but I think it was the most expensive.
I was directing the party in those days. So, yes, I was. I was directing that fund that spent the dark money.
So it was, you know, I think it was supposedly the most expensive state Senate race to that time.
Yep.
But, you know, it didn't really matter that I had many more donors, many more Michigan donors, many more donors in the district, or raised more, you know, clean money or whatever overall, because the money that could come in, it was all sort of unlimited. You know, I mean, I think we have basically we've got several problems that challenges for our democracy that will be very hard to overcome. Obviously, having California with 43 million people and Wyoming with what, 600,000, each having two senators. So, you know, people in Wyoming have many tens of times the representation that Californians have. And then the electoral college system, you know, is also a problem. But this, you know, the dark money in politics is a really big problem. And I went to law school, I think, well before, when was Citizens United decided? I went before
2010.
Then. Yeah, way before then. And so already the decisions that the Supreme Court had made sort of said money is speech. And Citizens United was just the culmination of that. And I never thought that was right. I never understood that. I mean, I don't get it. You know, if Mark is a, you know, a billionaire, and Jeff is a 100 millionaire, and I got, you know, two nickels rubbed together. I think in politics, you know, let's say the richer people can give some more, but the idea that unlimited money can, with no accountability, can flood into our politics, it's just really corrupting. So we have a lot of challenges. And then if they use the dark money to run a referendum to sculpt the electorate to their liking and disenfranchise poor people, people of color, and so forth, students, I mean, really, our democracy is in danger. And so everybody of good conscience needs to fight to protect it. And in fact, after this, I'm going to go to a rally to that effect, that the group Indivisible is organizing in Ferndale in my district. So I'm a member of Congress, but I don't really believe in the great person theory of history. I don't think most of the laws that really made progress in America came about because 535 people sat around and said, gee, let's try this. Almost all of them happened because of social forces and social organizations in society that said, you know, women should get to vote. You know, that African Americans need to be treated as equals in this country, that maybe even LGBTQIA plus people should be treated equally. Right. And it's not just that environmental. Look, Bill Milliken and the Republicans did a lot of great environmental stuff, but it came about when people organized against pollution. Right. And so it's not just Democratic or Republican. It's about people getting involved. And right now people need to get involved. And it's, you know, not just writing their, I'm all for them writing their member of Congress, calling, emailing, but people need to be out there organizing in their neighborhoods and, you know, marching around, writing the newspapers, whatever they can do to say that they don't want our experiment with democracy to go away, that they like it. It may be the worst form of government except all the others, but that, you know, they want to hang on to it.
Real and fundamental change has only come about in this country through the heat caused by friction. It doesn't, you're right, it doesn't happen by people just looking out for altruistic aims. Everything that's happened, be it the end of slavery, be it the women's vote, gay marriage, it's all come about through friction and organization and through protest. That's what it takes to forge change and real meaningful change in this country. And right now we all need to be alarmed about voting rights. When voting rights are taken away, they're going to be taken away from Republicans as well as Democrats. So Republicans who are trying to do this right now might think that they're, you know, this is somehow advantaging them until they're on the other side of the power in state capitals or in Washington. Once democracy goes backwards, it usually doesn't reverse itself and start moving in a forward direction again. And so, you know, you said it earlier, we're the only country, the only form of government that's ever been founded on an idea, not a power, not a cause, a king, an idea of freedom and liberty. And that applies to everybody, except now we have a major political party representing 74 million voters, most of whom are willing to let that go by the wayside.
We're not going to let it. We're just not going to let it. And I, you know, it's an amazing time for me personally, because, you know, I come from this political family. Right. And I guess the normal thing would have been for me to, you know, go to law school and run for state rep when I was 25 or whatever. And, you know, obviously I didn't do that. I mean, I spent my life in the labor movement, the environmental movement, the human rights movement. And I just, I feel great about being on the inside now, because I feel very connected with those forces in society that are, you know, that are demanding change and that look to us to try to implement change that makes life better for everybody. And so I welcome people getting involved. Democracy, if democracy is just an election, it's a thin gruel. I mean, we really, democracy needs to be about an educated citizenry, an activated citizenry. People, you know, when de Tocqueville came here and said, wow, this America is like this amazing country, he didn't say they run darn good elections. He said these Americans form every manner of organization to get together, to come together, to advance their interests and causes. That's what's great about America. And right now we really need people to stand up for our democracy. And it's going to take all of us. So,
and Andy, you've been a very passionate and articulate voice on behalf of those folks. But I think our time is up for this week. It really went by quick. So we got our great thanks to Congressman Andy Levin for taking some time to be with us today. And we're going to get him on his way to his rally for democracy in his district.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Mark. It's great to be with you. Good luck in your show. Take care.
All right. We'll see you again soon.
If you've got something to say to us or a question about Michigan politics, drop us a line. The email address is comments@arepublicpodcast.com, or you can add your comments on our Facebook page.
And if the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. I'm Mark Brewer.
And I'm Jeff Timmer. Back at you in a week.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on your favorite podcast app. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.